Hello and welcome to another edition of Banana Island Living Podcast. My name is Sade, and as I always do, I start by saying subscribe and recommend us to your friend and give us a five-star rating. Now, today I've just been a little bit concerned about finance and economics. And I think this is what has been on everybody's mind in Nigeria at the moment. With the volatility of the foreign exchange, we're getting to a certain time of life. Where do I put my money? Should I even, buy property? I mean, how many properties can you possibly buy? Liquidity is an issue. And fintech, everybody's hearing about fintech, crypto. And I don't know, I certainly don't know enough about it. And I thought I'd speak to somebody who's got his finger on the zeitgeist. Now, today I've got Victor. Victor's going to introduce himself in a minute, but I'll just tell you a little bit about his backstory, like I always do. Victor is the deputy director of AfriInvest West Africa. And he's in charge of strategy, business development, and he provides senior oversight on the group's infotech, such as the finance, risk, and controls. He was born in July 1979, and he's from Imo State, my state. Hello, Victor.
Hi, Shadi. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for coming on to talk us through the times that we're in and how to invest and what we should be doing and what you think. First of all, just tell me, are you into fintech at all?
Oh, well, most definitely.
You are?
Most definitely. Yes, most definitely.
Okay. I'm not going to ask you what's in your portfolio, but tell me, what do we mean by fintech in Nigeria? Because everybody is talking fintech. What is fintech?
Thank you. Thank you for the introduction and thank you for the platform. Indeed, I think I consider it a pleasure and a privilege to be here. I guess to answer the question, really, perhaps it's helpful to just talk about what fintech is. It's really an aggregation of two words. There's fin, representing financial.
Yeah.
And then there's tech, representing technology. So it's supposedly the meeting point between two disparate fields, finance and technology. So fintech essentially brings finance and technology together. A lot of the buzz around fintech fairly recently in Nigeria, I guess, might be attributed to the recent favorable announcements by two...
Like the $200... $1 million. The numbers I was hearing, that suddenly I started reading about.
Exactly. So there was, I think, the initial implied valuation of about $1 billion that was associated with the Flutterwave more recent capital raise, $170 million.
Yeah.
And then shortly thereafter, there was the announcement by the founders of Paystack, following the acquisition by Stripe of a $200 million investment that implied evaluation north of $1 billion as well.
Gosh.
Now, what that meant was that both companies, which had essentially a 5-year sort of run rate from
in
start
that short
to exit.
Time.
Exactly. So what created the buzz was the fact that when people then looked back and looked at the Nigerian Stock Exchange, for example, and said,
Return
wait a minute, what is the valuation on... What's the valuation placed on a GT Bank or a Zenith Bank in Naira, converted to dollars? You're like, oh my goodness, these guys barely started 5 years ago.
And you know what I really liked about those? Most of them schooled in Nigeria,
Yes, indeed.
They're local boys and they just did it. They used local talent and that for me was the high.
Yeah, so that was those were the two events that perhaps, really brought fintech into the mainstream attention of most Nigerians.
Is it really the big thing? Is it really? Is it that big?
I think it could be bigger.
Oh, right.
And I'll explain why. So what we've had with those two particularly is the fact that in some way, shape or form, they really represent a subset of the broader possibilities of fintech.
Right.
What do I mean? Both institutions, Flutterwave and Paystack, essentially focus on just one area, payments.
Payments, yeah.
They facilitate payments mostly for commercial enterprises who need to monetize sales and revenue.
Right.
And by enabling businesses across, you know, the spectrum, so from small, medium to large enterprises, providing the infrastructure to enable them aggregate payments from retail distribution and from, you know, just the mass consumer market.
Yeah.
They've built some value.
That's quite narrow, isn't it? It's a quite a narrow focus.
It's exactly. It's narrow. And so what they represent in a manner of speaking is an infrastructure.
Yeah.
A payment infrastructure. So they are an infrastructure play within the financial services space. All they've done is use technology to automate operations and therefore make it, what's the word? You know, they tend to use the word scalable or scalability, meaning you can therefore replicate that same model across so many other industries and sectors and across several geographies. So that's really the opportunity there. And there's where startups essentially hope to make some significant impact. You find an idea that you can, you know, you can hone in, you know, perfect it, find
in a narrow way, and then scale it up.
And then you can then scale it across several jurisdictions at, you know, several, you know, industry verticals. So that's one segment of fintech. The other part of it, which somewhat then brings us back to the earlier conversation when you started talking about investment, I know, brick and mortar, and, you know, looking at the market, people say invest in stock market, is another way. There is a need for what is effectively personal financial management. And that would then encompass investments on the one hand, as well as asset management. So for those who have built up some kind of value over time, you've been employed, you've earned salaries, you've built some sort of reserve, you own some property, you own some assets, you would like some professional to help you manage it in a way that works, customized for your own personal preferences and needs. Similarly, for younger people coming through the ranks who are trying to build some sort of capacity or build wealth, how do you do that in an environment like you have in Nigeria?
Well, that's what I was going to say, Victor, because I'll take those two segments you're talking about. If I was a young person in Nigeria now, I mean, the opportunities are tiny. How much money am I going to be able to put aside? Do I really? I want something quick. Hence the attraction of crypto, the attraction of get-rich-quick options or putting it into fintech. I don't have the time to build up a portfolio over time. And then also at the other end of the spectrum, I'm in my 60s, I've got properties. I don't have time to wait for something to crystallize. My payback period is going to be, hey, maximum 5 years, you know? In between those, where does fintech help? How does fintech help me? Where can I put my money?
So it's a fairly complex subject for that very reason. I think fundamentally, right, and this is something we in the asset management industry would normally talk about, or the investment management, is that for each individual, the recommendation or the proposal or the advice would be different. Because you do not have a one-size-fits-all type of approach. Typically, there's something we call an investment policy statement, which essentially looks at the profile of the individual in question. You try to, you know, understand the circumstances around their, you know, their current existence, you know, so how, what age bracket are they? What's the status? Are they married? Are they single? Do they have kids? You know, what level of education are they? Thank you. You know, all of that. You know, do they own their home or are they paying rent? You know, what
when
kind of lifestyle choices
do they
make?
When would they need their money?
Exactly. Exactly. You know, so there's all of that. You know, so are they employed or are they, you know, entrepreneurs? What kind of income bracket do they fall into? What kind of aspirations do they have? Do they want their kids to school in country, or do they have aspirations for sending their children to the US to do university or to the UK? All of those have implications for expenses down the line. And therefore, you then have to ask yourself, how do I manage this situation? I think, first of all, for young people, there's always been some sort of advice about, okay, start saving early, start making investments early. Now, while all that is, it's all nice and good.
I don't see that's going to work in Nigeria.
Exactly. Yeah. So I said, it's all nice and good, you know, and that's what I'm expected to say. But the truth, however, is that the biggest investment a young person can make in himself is in education.
Yeah.
And when I say education, it doesn't necessarily have to be formal. And I'll give an example. I've had calls to build out a digital team internally within the AfroInvest franchise fairly recently. And therefore, I've had to hire, you know, software developers, you know, from back end to front end to, you know, product designers.
Where do you find those in Nigeria?
There are a lot of them. It's so much. Nigeria is actually, you know, it's an untapped market when it comes to talent. And I think only fairly recently has the US market begun to rediscover Nigerian talent in the tech space. Yeah. And so the example I was going to give, so I've had one young man who lives in Ibadan. We hired him in November of 2019. November of last year. So this was during the lockdown. Yeah. So he was, so concluded discussions around September. He resumed in November. At the time he was in Oshogbo, he moved to Ibadan with his family and he was working out of Ibadan, supporting us in Lagos. You know, so even at that, there was some sort of value play where his income levels was much higher than his peers and his costs were much cheaper than his peers. So that was some value, sort of, there was a value gap there that, or a value bump that he was obviously leveraging. Now, as I speak to you, he's just resigned barely a year into a mandate. Why? Because he's actually been hired out of the US. He's been hired remotely from the US, 100% remote.
Whoa.
He's been offered a salary at $5,000 a month.
Whoa!
So it's a $60,000 a year package. And how does that work? In the US, a fresh graduate who gets into tech will probably earn between $75,000 and $100,000 base salaries, excluding other perks. Now, for an employer in the US hiring a remote, you know, developer out of Nigeria, he can afford to take a 40% shavings off the 100K. But that 60K salary is such a huge impact on the life of the young man.
Well, you know, in Nigeria, so that's huge. That is huge.
Exactly. You know, so that's, if I did 500 naira to the dollar, that's a 2 million naira a month salary. So he's clearly well ahead of, he's gone from, you know, whatever to top 1%.
Well, I was just going to say that we're going to have problems retaining our talent here in Nigeria.
It is a problem. It is a problem right now.
I know somebody at KPMG saying that they hire somebody now within 6 months, somebody's tapped them from Canada, they're gone. Sometimes it's becoming a problem in Nigeria.
It has been a problem for at least going on 2 years. I think it's only just gotten the notice of most people. I've seen this as far back as 2019. You know, it was a problem and it is accelerating. And it's really just it's symptomatic of a loss of hope young Nigerians. You know, so that comes back to the question you asked about how do you help them. So the point I was going to make is for a lot of young people, usually, unfortunately, our curriculum and pedagogy, which is a teaching method, sort of teach you to be, you know, they spread you thin across several, you know, subject areas. One of the things I've come to understand with time is that it's probably best to pick an area of, you know, real fascination and something that holds your interest, you can be passionate about, and then you drill down very deeply and become extremely knowledgeable in that area.
I would agree with you, except that as somebody in my later years, I still don't know what do I want to do when I grow up. So you're lucky to know that you wanted to do something. But some of us, it takes a while. You know, as some unkind person said, you know, another career cul-de-sac. Because you don't. It's so again, difficult to drill down when you're not sure.
I think the point I was making is for young persons who are starting out. You know, give yourself some latitude.
Yeah.
You know, from my experience, it's not too long. You know, 16, 17 years now. I tell young people, look, if you can find an employment in the first instance, whatever your hands find to do, take it with all your might, give it everything. That should allow you earn something to at least keep yourself together.
Yeah.
And in the first 5 years of your career, while doing that, you know, job, or while in that, you know, line of work, or in that sort of career trajectory, try to pick out areas that sort of align with your interests. Or if it doesn't fit, you can very quickly begin to understand, identify the areas where perhaps there's a passion, you are naturally built for it.
Yeah.
You have the natural either talent or inclination to pick it up. And then using the income you're earning from that salary that is not really, you know, your sort of preferred, begin to invest. And the great thing is, with technology today, you can learn a lot from free online platforms.
Yeah.
Google's YouTube is one of the most is one of the most fascinating sources of knowledge today. There is nothing you don't want. There's nothing you can search for on Google on YouTube. I beg your pardon. That you probably won't find a series of classes, even things like PowerPoint, Excel, which are fundamental tools we use in finance.
I use Google to learn how to change a particular type of light bulb that I didn't know.
Imagine, you know, so it's one of those things, right? You know, so I tell young people, look, yes, the internet is at your feet. Often you can use it for socials. You know, it's either you're playing around on Twitter, Instagram, but you have to strike a balance, right? So I'm not saying it has to be all serious, but, you know, sometimes just dedicate an hour a day to learn something. If you committed yourself 1 hour a day over 90 days, you'd have invested 90 hours. You know, that actually begins to build up, and it's cumulative, the impact of such learning. You know, so that's the first thing I usually say. Of course, there's also the other part of it, which is just understanding personal financial discipline. It comes from things like little things like budgeting, you know, so this is what I earn. How much of it goes into, and then just once you begin to track expenses, and there are all sorts of apps today that help with that.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, so this is what I spend on food, this is what I spend on transport, if it's, you know, taxis, Ubers, or if it's
bus. It can be a bit depressing though, looking at
it. Can be.
No,
it can
income be, but coming in, and look at my expenses.
Yes, it is. It is, you know. But what it does also is sometimes it just shows you up for where there is so much fat that you probably, you know, were blindsided to. You know, if you're the kind of person who eats out almost every day, suddenly you could realize that when you aggregate all of the expenses on pizza, on, you know, pastries, on, you know, food deliveries, it could be really, 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 you know, significant. And then therefore, once you have that insight into the data, it tells you, okay, perhaps I need to adjust this slightly, you know. So there's always the need to balance, but you just need to pay attention to some of those details.
You sound like a bin counter, and I'm depressed already.
I'm sorry, but finance is serious stuff, right?
It's serious stuff. It's a bit too serious for the non-serious it person serious like stuff. Me. But okay, say I decided to invest in fintech because I think I want to be on the ground floor of some of these new things coming out. And what I like is that it's not just the boys getting it. There are lots of women now in this.
Very true. Yeah.
How do I get into it? How do I put money? Because most of the money seems to be coming from abroad. Are they the only ones who see the potential? Because I have trust issues. I mean, I have serious trust issues.
Understandable.
Which one is kosher? How do I get into it? How do I even become an angel investor? Is that the way to do it? Or do I go into one of the funds?
Yeah, those are very valid questions. Very valid questions. Now, before I answer, I guess it's important to sort of set some sort of backdrop to how investments are made by VCs, venture capital firms, as against private equity. Now, usually, the finance spectrum, and I like to usually explain this to Nigerians who, when you talk to people about investment or startups or business and finance, they always talk about how, oh, the banks don't come through, Nigerian banks don't support. And I try to explain, they're not actually not designed for early stage businesses. Now, the business life cycle starts at what we call the early stage. So it's a startup, it's a fresh idea. And then, you know, it's a lot of risk at that point because it could be an idea or a business that exists within an existing industry, or it could be something that hasn't, that doesn't exist. And therefore, whoever is trying to pioneer that effort is essentially at the cutting edge of something that is totally new and unheralded.
And high risk.
So there's a lot of risk. It's high risk. So it's a bet on two things. So regardless of the idea, which is one of the things you're betting on. The real bet itself is on the person.
Yeah.
It's on the manager. It's on the driver of the business. You know, whoever that founder is. You're backing his character. You're backing his ethics and his
yeah.
truth, and then his competence. Yeah. So it's a judgment call. Once you go past the idea, it's look, do I trust this person enough to deliver on this idea? Even if he does deliver on the idea, would he be faithful to, you know, and transparent
and honest
enough
my
to
money.
Deliver the returns, you know?
I don't want stories. I want to get my money.
Exactly.
Back.
Now, the thing is, usually, when you have startups and then, you know, the way venture capital firms approach it, because it's implicitly high risk,
yeah.
the model for funding such ideas or such startups is one where they come into it with a lot of professional expertise.
By they,
they
who
have
do you
to
mean
find
they?
A way.
Who's they?
Venture capital,
okay.
venture capitalists. So those who make these bets.
Yeah.
Now, usually, if I was starting a business, first things first, I would have to, you know, find a way to raise some money to prove the idea, which is what some call POC, proof of concept.
Okay, so friends and family.
So it's friends and family. Yeah. Exactly.
Yes.
So sometimes I could bootstrap. Now, yeah. bootstrap means, I look around myself. How much cash have I saved up? Maybe my
credit
savings
card.
Account.
Burn your credit card.
You know, credit card, yeah. you know, burn
Smoke
it up. You know, maybe even sell
yes.
some assets.
Yeah.
You know, that's bootstrapping, yeah. where you sort of squeeze yourself,
yeah.
you know, dispose some assets, take your savings, you know, max out your credit card.
But if I was an investor, I'm more likely to put money in that kind of a person who, you know.
So that's exactly one of the things that investors look out for. It is how much, so it's called skin in the game.
Yeah.
So has this person demonstrated sufficient faith in his own idea by
yeah.
actually, you know, leveraging his own resources. So that's usually it's a good indicator as to how much faith the person has in that idea. So once you see that, it's a typically great, you know, feature to find. And that more often than not speaks to some sort of positive assessment of the idea of the person. Then you start out. You're trying to, you know, deliver some kind of, you know, service or good, you know, to a market. Have you sized that market? How large is that market? How deep is the market? Is there a proven market in that? It's a need validly, but are there customers who are willing and able to pay for the service? Because if not, then you're in a charity. So it has to be a business. There has to be something that people need and are willing to pay for. Then the question would become, how much traction have you made? You know, so yes, you've sold these things, you've raised some money, you've put the product out. How great is the product? How receptive it is? How many customers do you have? You know, are they repeat customers or are they one-off? What was the experience like? You know, then the question begins to drill down to understand, you know, how well that business is doing. Is it growing?
I mean, I've watched Dragon's Den and some of the calls they made. I don't know.
Exactly. So sometimes you see that, right? You don't quite understand it. You
yeah.
know, so there's all of that, you know, that goes into it. So what then tends to happen is, in the developed markets, you have what I call the full spectrum of the financial services available. So you go from, angel investing, or in fact, let's start with family and friends, which is more
yeah.
angel investing, you know, bootstrapping, angel investing. Then you have venture capitalists, then you have the private equity guys, and then you have mature markets where you have the IPOs, and then you have banks. So that's the actual spectrum.
Someone like me now, as an individual, I would be under the, say what, friends and family.
Friends and family.
So how do
friends
I invest in a company that I don't know? Like, but I want to get in on the action, like the Paystacks or the Flutterwaves. How do I even hear about them? How do they get their money? Do they come to Afri Invest or people like you?
Well, back 5, 7 years ago,
yeah.
2014, 15, and then coming down to 21, they would sometimes come to people like us, but not as much.
Because you people,
you know,
would not
so
have had the foresight to put money in there.
It wasn't that. For example, let me give an example. So there was a company that I met in 2014.
Yeah.
They were introduced by a law firm that we worked very closely with.
Yeah.
At the time, he was on the cusp of taking in a $10 million investment from a venture capital firm.
Wow.
However, the nature of the investment at the time was the document was worded to signify that most of the investment was going to be in kind, meaning they were going to be giving office space They will not have to pay rent.
Oh,
They
okay.
will provide the internet service. You know, so some of that question was, is that an ideal, you know, sort of investment to take? Or should they reconsider it? You know, so there needed to be a valuation around the business and what it was worth. So that was how we met these guys. He had raised money from one or two sort of friends, senior mentor types, who liked what he was trying to do, believed in him, and found him, you know, trustworthy. And then he put some initial money into the idea, and he built it to a point where, you know, there was now interest, because he had then secured the buy-in of the Nigerian, you know, what is effectively the payment exchange at the time, NIBS. So NIBS liked what he had done. It was a security product he created, essentially, to allow authentication of transactions to happen outside of the channel via which people were transacting. So if you're buying something online, you're trying to pay online, he had to have a way to authenticate the transaction outside of the window, because it was possible that a hacker can steal the session and steal your credit card details online. So how do you authenticate that in a way that the deal can still go through without necessarily going through the same channel? Great stuff. Now, he tries to raise money, speaks to a couple of Nigerians. Unfortunately, and it comes to the question you asked about, you know, how why is it, why does it appear that most of the funding
comes from
abroad, foreigners?
Yeah.
That's because a lot of the pockets of capital and those who have, you know, this the significant amount of wealth that allows the freedom and therefore the liquidity to take some of these risky bets. Many of them do not understand technology. And the idea of making an investment in something that to them is intangible is alien, you know, so they'll be like, look, you know, so they understand brick and mortar, that generation, right? You know, so if you're preaching about, oh, a real estate investment, I build this thing, I buy this piece of land, I develop this. So it's tangible. They can see it. They feel like, okay, if I give you the cash, I can touch it.
No, but don't forget, a lot of them put money into those banks, you know, the new wave banks at that time, and they got burned heavily. So presumably they have trust issues as well.
Indeed. So everything comes back to trust issues, right?
Yes.
But ultimately, it's also about what you're familiar with. If I start talking to, let's say, and I can, I just don't want to mention names, but I know a couple of billionaires, two of whom I've had calls to go pitch an idea to recently with one startup, B2B, in the media and entertainment space. So this gentleman, ex-telco guy, is a leader in the telecom industry, rose up to the level of CEO, 20 years experience, 7-year veteran from Nigeria to Ghana to Rwanda, Tanzania, you know, Congo. Solid guy. Came up with this product that essentially was designed to optimize the way in the telcos monetize the investment they had made in 4G. The biggest use case for 4G, for example, is video. You know, streaming video. And video requires, if you're going to stream high definition, it takes quite a bit of bandwidth. Now, data is expensive in Africa. So how can you deliver the same content at a fraction of the cost? So he created this solution that was going to enable the telcos run. And they were, so as I speak to you, he signed up, and this is as of 2019, December, he has signed up Airtel. Airtel had given him a contract for all 14 countries they operate.
Wow.
He signed up MTN in Nigeria and Ghana. And he was getting calls from as far as Cote d'Ivoire, from as far as Ethiopia to come deliver. And he was looking for $20 million to start out. But I, you know, we said, look, okay, let's stagger it. Let's start with a $5 million ask.
Yeah.
Start with the market and prove to investors that it can be delivered. And then we sat, I sat across from the table with one billionaire that I knew, you know, veteran Nigerian senior citizen who'd made money, you know, from oil and gas.
Yeah.
Was looking into this idea. And I said, okay, you know what? It sounds interesting. I would think about it. You know, his own big question really was about character. Can I trust you? If I give
you
this money, would you suddenly... Exactly. So would you not run off, you know, go buy a house in Seychelles, begin to smoke cigars, fly private jets up and down, you know, and living on the money rather than focus on the business? Or would you actually hunker down and build, you know? But you know what? Let me go do my character. Let me do my investigations and get some character references for you. And thankfully, it came back positive. And he then considered it. But then ultimately came back and said, you know what? Explain to me this thing. So where does this product, can I see it? You know,
it's can I like, touch no, but it?
It's a soft, exactly. It's like, it's software. It's going to sit on the cloud. Like, so what is the cloud?
Oh, you know, when you have such questions,
you realize that it's a problem. Yeah. Because the way you've explained the original thing, they understood it. But suddenly they're asking you about the product because it's thinking, if it goes bad, I want to take
I can
assets
carry the asset.
Because I believe I funded it. I can carry it. But unfortunately, it's intellectual property that sits on the cloud, which is essentially a server somewhere in the world. So that became a sticky point, and, you know, that stalled. I then took him to another banking entrepreneur, you know, one of the veterans of the new age banking in early 90s, who also had built something formidable, now very independently wealthy, who just says, so this thing you're trying to build, can I not build it? You know, why should I give you this much and take so small from you? You know, those sort of things, you know, and they're like, okay, well... but you know, this idea, all these tech things, I don't know, all this tech. Look, if it's just if you're enabling banking, I can understand. But when you say telco, that means you're going to compete against the telcos. We're like, no, you're an enabler. You're like, okay, so why can't they just take it and go and do it? You know, so again, they really couldn't understand it. You know, so there's always that challenge. But I think to sort of land or summarize the point, really, it's that unlike in the developed markets where you've had people, and I'll give very specific examples. So you've had the likes of Bill Gates, you've had the likes of, you know, Jeff Bezos,
Zuckerberg,
you know, even Tim Cook at Apple, Zuckerberg. Once they become very wealthy, you know, billionaires in their own standing, they then begin both individually and through the institutions they've built, begin to set up investment funds and create venture capital sub-institutions that then go out and aggressively look out for opportunities to invest.
Well, I mean, sometimes it's not just because they want to invest, it's to take out potential competitors, isn't it?
That's part of it. It's always, it's so not so much taking out as it is also very strategic.
Yeah.
So it's usually for strategic reasons. One is understand what the latest innovation out there is. You know, you can't outthink. At some point, some young kid will come up with some idea that could be complementary to what you're doing, which if you don't catch it early, could, you know, be lost. For example, YouTube wasn't a Google's product.
No.
But the guys at YouTube, at Google, and I saw a leak on Twitter recently where there was an email exchange internally between the founders where they said, look, those guys are doing better numbers than what we're doing. Their product is superior. The quality is great. Shouldn't we look at acquiring it? And, you know, there was a debate for months internally, and they did. And it's a fantastic deal.
Well, thank God
if they hadn't done it, perhaps, you know. Similarly, Android, you know, was something similarly acquired, you know. So the guy who built out that software, the, you know, OS for the phones, built the first devices, wasn't making a lot of traction, but wasn't doing too badly. But then they offered him a platform, and now it is the undisputed, you know, ubiquitous leader for smartphones in the world. So it's all of those sort of things that tend to happen where, you know, the bigger companies see an opportunity to keep, you know, to preserve their leadership. And, you know, yes, it's enlightened self-interest, but by looking out actively in across the spectrum, they can identify opportunities and pockets, and then they fund it. Now, here's the thing. When you do venture capital investing, it is extremely high risk, and the numbers suggest as much. There's a typical sort of rule of thumb in the industry.
Yeah.
Normally, when you're trying to do what is called the distillation process, which is for every opportunity you find, how many would you invest in? The average is that for every 100 opportunities you come across, you will typically only invest in one.
Gosh.
Then for every 10 you make an investment in, only one would actually turn out to be successful, a blowout success.
So one in a thousand.
So when you then think about
For unicorns.
Exactly. You're looking for unicorns. Yeah. Now, once you're doing that, it means that or from the get-go, you were somewhat comfortable with the idea that I'm going to lose money on 900 plus type opportunities. So what then do they do? So I know there are a couple of venture capital funds now in Nigeria. Wow.
Nigerian-owned or are they
Nigerian-owned. Okay. You have some of them. I don't know if I want commercial names because if it's, you know, advertising or not, but I know of a certain gentleman who's a lawyer who's made quite a lot of money from, you know, being an investor in MTN, who through a firm that I know has seeded a fund. They've raised $10 million and the idea is to make up to 40 investments of potentially up to $250,000 each.
In fintech?
Yeah, across all sorts of startups. Okay. Of course, fintech is one of such segments. Now, if they're going to write 40 checks, what are the odds that all 40 will come back successful? You know,
maybe one.
Maybe one, exactly.
But then the payday could be big.
That's the point, you know. So usually of the 10 you invest in, the, again, rule of thumb is that one could deliver 8,000 or 10,000% return. Yeah. Six of them essentially will go bust, and then three would break even. So that one blowout, you know, unicorn success could then compensate you for the other losses you've incurred. So that's the sort of numbers. Now, given that scenario, it is highly unlikely that the average individual should be doing venture capital.
Clearly, don't think I should be going there.
Now, are there ways to do it? I can also tell you, thankfully,
there's mutual funds. Is that one?
Not necessarily mutual funds. So there is a different approach to venture capital that someone introduced sometime last year.
Okay.
You know, so the gentleman is one of the pioneers and founders of Flutterwave, Inya Boyegi.
Okay.
So yeah. He set up this thing called I forget the name now, but essentially it's a venture capital play. And what he's tried to do is, because he's already plugged into that ecosystem of fintech, you know, startups, he's already raised money. So he's raised money from investors. So the investors know him. And then others who are looking to get in, sometimes, you know, startups reach out to him. So he says, look, I continue to see a pipeline of opportunities, many of which I can't fund individually. But if we pull together as a collective, almost mirroring a mutual fund structure, what happens is you pay a membership fee, an annual membership, I think it's at $500 a year. And that gives you access to, I think, maybe 20 or 30 deals a year. You know, which would then start at a minimum investment of maybe, I think, either $5,000 or something of the sort. So you get to see all of those pitches. And if there's one that strikes you, resonates with you, there's a, you know, there's an investor pitch event. You dial in, you listen in, you ask questions. You know, once the deal is structured,
it'd be like a Y Combinator or one of those.
Somewhat something of that sort. So it's sort of modeled somewhat that way. Just that, again, this is more collective investment than institutional. So that's essentially one of such approaches. And then there is another, this started as a WhatsApp group of Nigerians in diaspora, mostly in the US, professionals, you know, so doctors, lawyers, you know, accountants, you know, finance executives, who essentially sort of got together, set up a WhatsApp group and said, we need to start co-investing, you know, investing together.
Wow.
So if we could do $5,000, $10,000 there, whenever they come across opportunities, they invite them into the group. The guys will come in, drop, you know, materials. They read it. Then they now do a Zoom session where, you know, these guys will pitch.
Or are they on Clubhouse? Because everybody seems to be going on Clubhouse to pitch now.
No, this is not on Clubhouse. It's so they moved to Telegram now because of size. You know, it grew too large for WhatsApp. You know, so there's a Telegram group with nearly 1,000 of such people. And then, you know.
Gosh.
So it's growing. And I know it funded a couple of things. One of such is there's a new sort of discount retail store that operates in Lagos out of two locations that was funded out of that 3 years ago.
You're a font of information, Victor. You're a good guy to know.
I have to keep my ears closed because like I told
your
you
finger on the pulse of the nation.
Yeah,
so which are the new sort of fintechs we should look out for? I mean, there's a Flutterwave, there's a Paystacks, there's the Paga. Which are the ones that, you know, we probably haven't heard of that much, but they're going to rise to the top soon?
There are quite a number that are coming up.
In that narrow field we talked about earlier?
So in finance, I think, you know, this is my personal view. I think Flutterwave, Paystack have taken the cake on payments. I think Paga is more or less the dominant player in what is effectively agency banking and payments.
Yes, agency banking.
It's I think it's over north of 10 million accounts or users now. So that's pretty dominant. It's gone. I don't see any other payment company coming in and essentially dominating those two.
Getting the same kind of traction now.
No, I think it's
that
segment is sealed, really.
Yeah.
Then there is still room in the sort of financial planning, investment management, asset management, investing space. And you have a few people sort of punching there, albeit within the challenges of, you know, regulations. And more recently, you did allude to the fact that there was a CBN clampdown.
Well, You know, I knew we were going to spend too much getting, if we get into CBN and this our recording will go on forever. Can you just tell me in a very quick way this government regulation issue? Because it seems like they're playing cat and mouse. I'm following some of these fintech people on Twitter.
Correct.
And it's like, so how can we get over this new government directive? How do we, you know, it's like, what's going on in that sphere with government regulation? And
so it's not a binary issue, and it's a bit more complex and nuanced than it's getting than the sort of conversation is allowing for. There are two perspectives, right? So there is first of all the what I call the irreverence of the young Nigerian. The average
lack
young
of,
person
lack of respect for rules. You mean
it's. I wouldn't call it a lack of respect for rules as it is a lack of inhibition from testing and trying out new things.
Well, that's a good thing, though.
It's a good thing. Well, that's an essential ingredient
what you need for
that's an essential ingredient for innovation. It's a lack of fear, an irreverence for laid down procedures and standards. It's about questioning the status quo. So that is required to drive innovation.
Can I get around it?
Yes. Unfortunately, however, a lot of the activities in the financial space is heavily regulated for good reason.
And it has to be.
It has to be because, it's called a fiduciary responsibility, meaning that you have a responsibility to the stakeholders. Mm. And it includes, for example, in banking, the central bank not only has a responsibility to depositors and therefore the average Nigerian, it owes a duty of care to the banks themselves to ensure that the system is stable and collectively to the nation, because the country's economy is largely underpinned by financial services. So it has a three sort of layered concentric circles, if you like, responsibility matrix that it must at any point in time meet. The challenge with startups is sometimes they come into an opportunity, they see a niche, an area where there's a gap, they innovate to introduce a solution, and then they go to market. However, in financial services, you have regulators and you have regulations. If you don't comply with those regulations, you risk running afoul. Mm. And more often than not, the first thing to do sometimes is actually to go to the regulator and say, look, here's something we're trying to do. How can I do it in a way that is legal? It doesn't run afoul of the law, but also allows me the room.
Yeah, but I'm sorry. Our own regulators and government and authority here doesn't seem to have that sort of helpful relationship. It's almost like they're trying to stop you, whatever you're trying to do. So, it's very difficult for you to go to a ministry or something and say, look, how can I get this done? The first thing they need is, how do I get money off you? And how do I stop you from achieving it? Which is not helpful to the economy.
Sure. So we're now getting to the other side of it, right? So which is, and it comes back to a sort of broad big picture vision of what it means to run an economy. Unfortunately, there is a disconnect, between the managers of the economy on the one hand,
and the players.
And that disconnect varies quite markedly. I, for example, work in an industry where we're regulated by the SEC. Mm. And I can say that the SEC is actually very progressive in its regulation of the space. For example, before the CBN, affected the ban on cryptocurrencies, even though it says it didn't ban cryptocurrencies, but rather the exchanges.
Yes.
The SEC had set out an exposure draft of rules governing operations and the sort of the lay of the land for cryptocurrencies. And that it did with the active participation of operators in the industry. So we had sat with the SEC, they had written out the rules, we had given feedback comments, they had modified, sent it back, and we had adopted, and then it was adopted before the CBN then clamped down, which then made the SEC sort of suspend the implementation of those rules. Now, there is obviously a regulatory incongruence between these two institutions, right? And we've said to the SEC, perhaps you want to go, liaise with the CBN, find a way to address their concerns, which are valid, right? So they're valid concerns, but we need to find safe spaces, you know. So we call it a regulatory sandbox where people can come in, test ideas. The CBN sees it up close, understands what the issues are, assures itself that all the key risks that it, you know, essentially identifies have been addressed or at least mitigated. And
but it's a relationship issue, isn't it?
It's a relationship issue. So there's a responsibility on both sides. For the startups, now they're beginning to understand that there's a need to have government, you know, regulatory liaison, and that those conversations have to be an ongoing one. And I think on the part of government, you know, now we're speaking to some of them to say, look, guys, the unemployment levels in this country are atrocious. They're at levels never seen before. Yeah. There's 3%, you know, youth unemployment, another sort of 17% underemployment. We have essentially a youth bulge where 2/3 of Nigerian youth, 2 in every 3, are out of work. So it's a crisis.
Well, I'm seeing a demographic as well that are not just youth. People in their late 40s, early 50s are underemployed and
very.
And actually
it's
scared.
It's a nightmare.
Scared of what's going to happen.
It's a nightmare. It's a nightmare. Yeah, so that's part of the issues around you know, unemployment and insecurity. A case in point, Twitter. There's been the suspension of Twitter, ostensibly on account of, you know, government says, oh, they've been undermining national security by, you know, giving Philip and a voice to the likes of NSARS. Unfortunately, like Instagram, Twitter is a huge commercial space.
I know.
A lot of young Nigerians, you know, do business, you know, mostly commerce on Twitter. So by suspending it, some others who run all sorts of platforms, you know, some of them speaking engagements, some classes where they teach financial, you know, literacy, has all been shuttered.
Some of these young Nigerians and not so young ones, they're so clever in their use of Twitter. You know,
exactly.
Not even the business, the wit that comes through, they can actually get exposure from the way they use space. There's a Nigerian girl, I think I interviewed her dad, who became very popular and became really famous. She's a fantastic writer. People got to know her through her use of Twitter. Now she's got a book, she's got things. And it's heartbreaking if that sort of opportunity is shut down. We could go on. I'm really enjoying this, and I'm sure we're going to have a conversation outside this podcast, because me, I want to pick your brain.
Indeed.
Without pain.
No, that's fine. Yeah, that's fine.
The last question I'm going to ask you, a business question.
Yes.
Before I get to know you, is this one is about NFTs.
Oh, right.
I want a quick answer because it's such a big topic. But I promised myself I will learn something. First of all, is it in Nigeria at all? Is it something?
Yes. The answer is yes.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. So expand that quickly. Who is doing non-fungible tokens in Nigeria, and can one invest in it?
Thank you. So non-fungible tokens, as you said, are essentially a use case of blockchain technology as well.
Yeah. The same background to the crypto.
The same blockchain. Same. Exactly. So blockchains, actually the technology underpinning blockchains, which is the DLT, distributed ledger technology, essentially allows you to create unique identifiers for transactions that form a part of a block and then become immutable, meaning you can't change it. To have it changed or modified, you have to go replicate a change on every single computer that is a part of that network, which is therefore very impossible. Now, what has happened is, beyond cryptocurrencies, which is one use case of blockchains, you are able to use cryptocurrencies to do land administration and to create a liquid market for real estate. As I speak to you, I'm aware that there's a Nigerian company that's also pioneering in that space, blockchains for real estate. Yes, I'm not kidding. Then NFTs. Now, NFTs are essentially, when you say it's non-fungible, fungible means, you know, you can sort of switch from one pocket to the other, you know, move things around. The fact that it's non-fungible means that token is tied to an asset.
Right.
Now, the question is, how do you define assets? What blockchain and NFTs have basically done is allow the creation, or allows you to therefore convert whatever you can think of into an asset. I'll give an example. So some of the more common things that we see, there are a lot of young Nigerians who do a lot of artwork, starting out while they're still studying art in school.
And memes.
And memes. So from video memes to comedy skits to
all of
that is intellectual property.
Yeah.
So that is all intellectual property that if you don't lay, you know, how do you assert your IP on that, such creativity? There are artists, I know a Nigerian artist who started out in Enugu doing this, you know, hyper realistic type, you know, work.
Can you
painting
name
people? His name is, it starts with an A, Ayogu.
Okay.
I think it's Ayogu, is it?
I will check him out, yeah.
Now, my CEO found him on Instagram, right? Commissioned the work that he did that was fantastic. At the time he found him, he was actually in the US on a holiday trip. And the guy delivered the job, sent it over, and then he sort of put him on his timeline. And, you know, the boy blew up. He brought him to Lagos. This guy has close to 1 million followers now on Instagram.
Wow.
Right? And he's able to... Now, for someone like that, he can do jobs that he can then create an NFT on and begin to monetize. So that way, whoever buys a piece of that, whoever buys a replica or a piece of that particular
art, a token,
ultimately, he's able to monetize consistently for as many copies of that artwork are delivered. So that's what it is. Now, you could do the same thing for voices. You have a fantastic radio voice, for example. You can, some point in the future, monetize this.
monetize
your
voice.
Podcast. You can create an NFT around your voice.
I think you and I will have a conversation after this.
My poverty-stricken days are over,
I think.
So you can monetize anything, you know. If you thought you had a beautiful face and a smile, you could then, you know, create an NFT around your brand and image. So that's all of that.
Nigeria. That's what, I mean, I just...
Yes,
what
I say is in Nigeria, it's basically saying that I know Nigerian artists who have NFTs issued against their, you know,
so how do you issue it? How do they issue it?
Products. So that's where it gets a bit technical, right? You know, so you have to
get in touch with somebody who would then...
So you have to prove the IP, for example, the fact that, oh, this is an original work you created. You have to put a date stamp on the work. And then there has to be a way to validate that you own that product. And then thereafter, you can go on one of the exchanges and then create a token to back that product and then list it.
Victor, you have to come back and talk me through this. Because we've talked in so many... topics, and I don't, you know, I feel that each one of them is big enough for us to talk for another hour. But before you run away, you know, you we're gonna get to the joke, and you can't escape that one.
I'll try.
You practice it as we're going on. Okay, so what is the one thing you still have to do? I mean, you've been an engineer, you're a financier now. What is on your bucket list?
Learn to play classical piano.
Ha! Okay. Do you play piano now?
I started learning as a child, but never quite took it serious. Yes.
Right. So you didn't take the exams or anything?
No, not at all. No.
Okay. Sunday morning, church or chill?
Church.
Oh, good. Excellent. Good boy. So tell me the one person you admire the most.
My current CEO is one person I admire a lot.
How to win friends and influence people. I hear you.
No, so it's and I can explain it, right? So it's he's what I find to be a perfect blend of intellect and empathy.
Okay.
So he's a first class graduate, so very sharp, very smart. But then his ability to build relationships. So I have access to his contacts, and he has over 10,000.
Wow.
Contacts that he maintains actively right from when he started his career at Goldman in 1991. So it's one of the things I admire him for. I'm largely an introvert who's learning to now have to build, you know, that extroversion or extroverted capacity, because at the senior levels in an investment bank, you have to win mandates. So you need to develop that skill.
Yeah.
So I admire him for being able to strike that balance.
Yeah.
And then he also does a lot of personal charities. You know, I called him up 2 weekends ago. He was somewhere in the East. He's sponsoring a football tournament.
Wow.
And then he flies up. He's doing a business deal. Then he flies back. He's with his family at dinner. You're like, okay, I can't talk to anyone right now. You know, so being able to strike that balance in a country like Nigeria, for me, I think it's phenomenal. I admire him for that.
And I can tell you that won't hurt your promotion either. Okay. So if you weren't doing what you're doing, what would you have liked to do? What would have been your dream job?
I might have been a music producer.
You have this music thing in your mind. You're going to be the Jay-Z. The Jay-Z life
music. Maybe run a record label.
Yeah. Okay, well, it's big in Nigeria now, so yeah.
Yeah, it's picking up.
It's happening. So are you a morning person or a night owl? You sound disgustingly like a morning person, honestly, I tell you.
You
sound like one of those people who would wake up early and say, let's go jogging, exercise.
No, not at all. That's my wife. I'm extremely nocturnal. Extremely nocturnal. I think it's a problem because I can't sleep before midnight. I'll wake up too early.
A man after my heart. I don't know.
I was up till 2 a.m. this morning, for example, right? Yes. 2 a.m., 2:30. It's normal. I function best at night.
How do you wake up in the morning, though? How do you get to work in the morning? It's a challenge.
Painfully. I have to. Yeah, it is. most morning. So I have it on clockwork. So I have my alarm. Yeah. I use a smartwatch, which also measures my sleep because I try to get the same quality sleep. So it's at least vibrates on my wrist. I have like three alarms. So one I close off at maybe 5:30 and then one at 6:30. So if I need to be in the office at 8, then I at least can get up at 7 and then dash across.
you rush across the
bridge. Yes. So there's that. I'll sleep in.
Okay.
If I had the chance to.
So what are you reading at the moment? What book are you reading?
It's a book on Nigeria's history. It's called Formation.
Do you know this is the second authors, person who's telling me about this book?
Yes. It's really interesting, actually. Yes, I do. We were colleagues at he used to work with AfroInvest actually, Fola Fagule.
Yes. It's definitely on my to-do list.
It's extremely well researched. I think it's the most comprehensive sort of compendium on Nigeria's history.
Everybody has been waxing lyrical
about it. Over 200 years.
Yeah.
Very well researched, very well written. Fola is an excellent writer, so I thought he would do a good job of it and it was a fantastic piece. Yes.
Well, if I buy it, can you help me to get it signed by him?
Oh, I will. I will definitely do that. Obviously, speak for that. I'll do that.
We've got a date on that. So, what are you listening to? What's on your Spotify or iPod?
I'm not a Spotify person.
Are you listening to a particular podcast at the moment? If it's not music, because you're musical, there's got to be a song that's
playing. It's music, right? It's music. Yeah. The last what's currently on my playlist is this guy's newest album. Well, his first album, actually. Thinking about it,
which one?
Johnny Drill.
I never even heard of Johnny Drill. God, I need to get Apple.
My goodness,
I need to get Apple.
So he has a new album out. I've had a new album in the past week. So I've listened to Drake.
Is he a rapper? Really, is he R&B?
No. So Johnny Drill he doesn't fit into any of those stereotypes. His music, his sound is extremely unique, and I love it. It's almost a blend of R&B and soul.
Right.
You know, with a touch of jazz. He's awesome.
I'll keep checking him out. Okay.
You should.
Are you watching anything on DSTV or Netflix?
Unfortunately, I don't do DSTV anymore. I went off DSTV 2018.
At least it's not Big Brother Niger. I can't get over how.
I can't do that.
So
I can't.
Not me.
It's not me.
Yeah.
It's not even about age. I just can't find myself. What I do is, I just do movies basically. Every evening now, I try to do a movie before I sleep. So from about midnight, I'll watch a movie. You know.
No wonder you don't sleep till 2.
it's a way of distressing for me. So after I've had a day, very busy day, thinking numbers, finance, you know, stuff like that.
So your brain and then you.
Yeah, and just try and
Okay. So what was the last one that you watched that really resonated with you? And it's not something to do with money.
No, not at all. Not at all. So I saw a movie last night called Kate.
Okay, what is it about?
On Netflix.
Okay.
It's set in contemporary Japan. looks at, so Kate is a Western child who was brought up in Japan by another Western gentleman.
Oh, wow. Is it a real story?
I'm not sure. Right. That's the funny thing. It's probably fiction, but yeah. It plays on a lot of the themes that are Japanese. So, for example, the whole family concept, the Yakuza.
Okay.
And betrayal, you know. So she eventually was trained by this, you know, father figure, became an assassin, but then he then turned around and set her off, and then she was poisoned with polonium.
Guys, that's
pretty interesting, but it was fun.
Yes, okay, well, that's definitely a brain parking exercise. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, so describe yourself in three words.
I'll say laid back.
Okay.
Smart.
I like the lack of modesty. Well done.
I never like to do that, but
nobody's
honest.
I just
have to admit it. I hear it often. So I just have to admit it. So laid back, smart, and
it's funny how the third one is always a challenge.
Should I say passionate or committed? But somewhere there, essentially, I'm an all or nothing kind of person. So if I commit to something, it's 100%. So
it's passion.
Committed,
you've
passionate.
Got, commitment. Yeah. Fantastic.
Yes.
Okay. So this is the bit you probably hate, and you have to tell me a joke.
All right.
I don't know why people hate it so much. Why is it so difficult?
No, it's not okay. I won't say I hate it. It just wasn't, and it wasn't something I would expect. It was part of an interview. Yeah. Okay. So let me tell this one. Right. So, basically, it's a statement, right? And I think it goes like this. So. There is usually no person more respectful than someone who wants to borrow money from you. He can walk into your house and see your dog and go like, "How are you, Bingo? How are you? Hello." You know?
They'll be greeting everybody until they get
greeting
that
everybody
money.
And everything, you know, until he gets what he wants, basically. Well,
especially in the Nigerian context. Sir,
in the
Nigerian
context,
weekend?
Yes, definitely.
Yes. Happy weekend.
Yeah, exactly.
I just came to greet you.
Yes.
I came to check how you are. Well, I mean, thank you so much, Victor. I think it's been an investment masterclass. I have a little bit more than surface idea about the fintech industry. I still want to get to talk to the actual players in this field, the fintech guys. So I'm putting the word out there. But you've been amazing, and you've made everything sound so easily comprehensible, not least the non-fungible token, which I thought I would never get my head around. I just didn't think I'd be able to get my head around. So how do people get in touch with you if they want to? Would you would you mind if people got in touch with you?
No, I don't actually.
Okay, so what are your media handles and how do they get in touch with you?
So for media, I'm quite active on Twitter, which is really where I'm active.
So are you tweeting from abroad or from Nigeria? How I catch you.
It's all of that stuff. Yeah, so I'm an Android user.
Yeah,
and for
so
Android,
you
can
you're
actually
cheating.
Just no, not necessarily. All I have to do is just change my use a proxy server.
Yes.
So I can change the settings to a proxy server, and I can then tweet. Yeah, so that's what I do.
So what's your handle on Twitter?
So it's at Victor Kuboski, and the Victor is spelled with a K, V-I-K.
Yeah, T-O-R.
T-O-R, and then Kuboski is K-U-B-O-W-S-K-I.
Okay. Are you on Instagram?
No, not on Instagram.
LinkedIn?
LinkedIn, definitely. My full name's Victor Ndukuba.
Okay.
I'm also on Facebook, actually.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I have a Facebook account, but I rarely use it.
Very rarely, I know.
Yeah.
I think it's funny enough, in the UK, older people are more on Facebook, and in Nigeria, younger people are on Facebook. It's an interesting one. But thank you so much.
Thank you.
Whichever platform you're on, wherever you're listening to us from, please subscribe and share and give us a rating. And you can write to us, mail@bananaislandliving.com. Twitter, we're tweeting from wherever at banana Banana underscore living. And we're, we have a good presence on Instagram at Banana Island Living. So listen and talk to you again in 2 weeks' time. Thank you. Bye.